This morning's message is somewhat different from the usual heard from this pulpit. About 2 months ago, I spent 17 days traveling overseas, India, and many people have asked me about that trip. So this morning, I want to share with you some of my impressions and observations about this marvelous experience over there. First of all, we should keep in mind that this message comes in two parts. First of all, talking about the external physical aspects of the journey, and then secondly, and more importantly, some of the basic spiritual messages that I picked up over there. We should bear in mind that India, the land mass is about one-third as large as Canada, and its population is about 1.1 billion people. And so you find masses of people everywhere you go, in the terminals and on the streets and every place. You find lots and lots of people everywhere. Its population is about 35 times bigger than ours. And so the first impression you have, as I got off in Delhi, it was almost midnight, and even then the streets were filled with traffic. The traffic over there is simply unbelievable. In most of the streets and cities and towns aren't much wider than this chancel. And in those streets you'll find teeming crowds of people, and there's no sidewalks. So you'll find the streets filled with people and cars and bicycles and bicycle rickshaws, auto rickshaws, and you'll find cows walking around. So there's lots of activity every place you go. And by the same token, the noise level is simply incredible. With the constant hawking of the cars and the bicycles and the vendors hawking their wares and people speaking very loudly in general, so that the noise level is very, very high. And you're also struck by the poverty all around you. Every place you go, you are accosted by beggars of all ages, children, as even younger than Bob and Chris's children here, and older people in their 70s and 80s. One of the saddest things, and I saw this several times, were maybe a dozen or 15 widows sitting up against a wall, each with their hand out, or just sort of a little metal pan, asking for rupees. And this goes on all day long. The poverty is so stark. And every place you look, it looks rather uncared for and well-worn. There's very little that is new or clean or shining. All of life is very much in your face. It's raw. And it's completely in your face. In some ways, it reminds me of growing up in a small prairie town in the 1930s in the Big Depression, where babies were born at home and the old folks died in their own bed. Everything was handmade, homegrown. There again, life was, there was nothing artificial or unreal or plastic. It was all very real and vital, full of energy. This is one of the big differences between the East and the West in general. In the West, where we live, by and large, life is very convenient and comfortable and sanitized and clean. And if we want things, we can jump in our car and drive to a shopping mall and pick it up. Over there, I didn't see one shopping mall in my entire trip. And so it's a totally different perspective. I recently heard someone make the comment that in the East, that in the West, we think of life as being linear, in a straight line, whereas in the East, life is thought of as being circular. And there's a lot of food for thought in that image. At the same time, things are changing so fast over there. In Canada last year, our gross national product was about 2.5%. Over in India, it's almost 10%. And so the place is just simply, it's exploding. And the middle and upper classes are growing very quickly. At the same time, over 40% of the population live on less than $2 a day. On less than $2 a day. And so India faces enormous problems. How do you elevate, improve the lot of 500 million people? So it faces some major problems, obviously. But the government is poor. I just recently read that over there, only 25 million people pay taxes out of a billion. And so there the government has very little involvement in the private life of these poor people, virtually none. For these half billion people, there's no medical health system, there's no pensions of any kind, and the government simply stays out of your life completely. For example, for the first 6 days, I was in a city called Vrindavan, which has about 60,000 people in it, and there's no garbage pickup in Vrindavan. And so garbage and litter is strewn every place. It's all covered with garbage. And so after you're exposed to all of this, you become aware that for all of these hundreds of millions of people, their main preoccupation, in fact, their sole preoccupation in life, is keeping body and soul together. They've got no energy or money or time for anything else but just simply surviving. The last 6 days of my visit, I was on the east part of India, not far from Calcutta, at an ashram. As you know, ashrams are places where people go for spiritual enlightenment and nourishment and fellowship. There were about 1,000 people there. And the days, those last 6 days, they were totally filled with religious issues. There's worship and there's lectures and there's meditation and there's reading and meeting people and talking with them, but your sole preoccupation is on religion. It really was quite interesting. I met a dozen or 15 of Matthew, our son Matthew's friends, and not once were we ever talking about world affairs or about Iraq or about George Bush or about anything else. You're simply talking about religious concerns and matters all day long. The people over there feel that what Krishna needs and wants more than anything else is simply worship, veneration, and devotion. Those of us who were here last Sunday will recall Reverend John saying that the number one priority in life should be serving uses and helping people, simply being living a life of service. And in the West, this is number one. But in India, number one is simply adoration of God. Now, all of this may sound somewhat negative when you hear about the squalor and the filth and the poverty and the begging and the noise, in some ways, maybe it doesn't sound all that appealing. And yet there's something so winsome and attractive about India. Before I went, I was talking with a couple of people who had been there, and they said that India will leave its mark on you. And it does. It really leaves a very deep psychic impression on your spirit. I might just mention that the caste system has been abolished by the government some years ago, but of course, traces of it still loom large. It is there in all sorts of very subtle ways, some not so subtle. But this brings us into part two of this morning's message. And these are some spiritual insights, and they're not particularly new. We've heard them before, but they were all reinforced and confirmed on this visit to India. First of all, and this also is very big in the Buddhist world, the importance of being aware of the present moment. So much of us are used to thinking, and if we can track our daily thinking process, we're almost always thinking about what's coming up next, what's coming up next hour or next day or next week, or we're thinking about past issues and regrets and this and that. But not too often are we completely and totally focused on this present moment that we are feeling and experiencing right now. And over there, this becomes much easier than here, simply because there's no outside distractions. For those entire 17 days, there was absolutely no television, there was no newspapers, no magazines, there was no radio. There were no outside distractions whatsoever. And it's so interesting to see how one's thinking changes within 4 or 5 days, and I wasn't even conscious of it. But within 4 or 5 days, I was aware that I wasn't thinking about anything else back home or in Iraq or about anything else in the world, because I simply wasn't having this kind of input. And so I forgot, I excluded, I shut out literally everything else, and I became really totally aware of what I was doing every present moment. It was amazing how one's senses, both physical senses and also spiritual senses, are greatly heightened and somehow magnified in that kind of a situation. It's quite amazing how the whole thought process, it kind of slows down, and you really do become aware of things around you. Something like when we hear of when a person is given, say, a month to live, and you'll be dead within the next month, and how these people all say, I became totally aware of the days I had left, and every moment was cherished so deeply. And so it is that life in general becomes much more alive and real in that kind of a setting. So this is my first point. Secondly, the acceptance of life as it is. The acceptance of life as it is. Now, this is a two-edged sword, obviously, because very often in life we come across situations that are wrong, and that need to be rectified and improved, and we have to make some external changes in things, and this is very important. But other times in life, after we've done all we can possibly do, we've given it our best shot, we can't do anything more, and all we can do then is simply accept that situation as it is and give it over into the loving hands of God and trust that God will care for us. But at some moment, we have to learn how to accept the situation as it is. And over there, I sensed, this is a very strong impression I had, that those people who have had such terribly hard, difficult, poor lives, and yet they've reached a point where they're aware that they can't do much about it, and so they have just simply accepted their situation. And you see this in their faces. I've never, ever seen so many beautiful, dignified, strong, character-filled faces. It shines in their eyes. And you can sense that these people have been able to accept their hard lot in life. They're going with the flow. And there's a sense of inner equanimity and inner peace that they've achieved. Thirdly, the life of the Spirit permeates everything over there. Well, it's over 5,000 years old, their faith. And of course, Swedenborg tells us that many, many thousands of years ago, even way before that, there was what he called the most ancient church. There were people on the planet who were in direct communication with the spiritual world. Life was very simple and basic. But they had spiritual ideas thousands of years ago. And he says that these people lived in what he calls Greater Tartary. By this he means southern China and Nepal and northern India. So this all began tens of thousands of years ago, where there were spiritual geniuses living in that part of the world. And of course, Hinduism then grew out of that. And so it takes place in all sorts of ways. For example, when I met all of Matthew's friends, first things, you would always go like this, Namaste. Which means that I trust and respect you. This is a very small example, but of the spiritual atmosphere that just simply fills all of life over there. And for example, every Hindu child has learned that Krishna creates and sustains all of life. And so this is a cultural thing. It's part of the air they breathe, that the invisible world is the real world. And when we really believe this, it changes everything, as it has over there. They believe that the spirit is paramount. It comes first. And then fourth, the idea of karma looms large. Again, this is a cultural thing. Karma, very briefly, means as we sow, so shall we reap. It means that we are responsible for our own spiritual destiny. We create our own worlds, both here as well as after we die. It means that every action, both large and small, has certain consequences. This is karma. And of course, over there, with their belief in reincarnation, they believe then, hopefully, that they'll be on a higher spiral the next time around. But this gives them this sort of simple, childlike trust in the life process, that I can do good things, I can improve my lot, it'll be better for me next time around. Now, as I said, none of this is new. We've all heard these ideas many times, and they're all totally Swedenborgian, completely Swedenborgian. But over there, one senses that the people live out these principles. It's part of the way that life is understood and accepted and lived. It's so much part and parcel. It's the fiber of their being. All of these things I've been talking about, they're not so much discussed, but they're assumed. This is the way life is. And so I felt very, very much at home over there, even though there was the squalor and the noise and everything else, but yet so much dignity and strength and beauty and color, vibrant colors, just amazing. And so we can learn from our Eastern friends. Certainly, they can also learn things from the West. Obviously, this is a two-way street. But in general, I am striving to cultivate a few more of those good Eastern ways of living and thinking, because it is good for the soul. Amen.